welcome to our very first podcast of Mythic Imagination. I'm Honora Foa, the creative director and co-president of Mythic Imagination Institute. And here in the studios of Creative Digital Group with me is Andrew Greenberg, who is the co-chairman of the Mythic Journeys Conference. Many of you will be learning about those conferences and the other activities that Mythic Imagination Institute does, but I think let's just start off by going right into some juicy material about myth and about story, and then we can talk more about activities that Mythic Imagination likes to work with myth and story. Our favorite tagline is, every life is a story, and a story can change the world. So today we're going to talk a little bit about stories themselves and go into the idea of individual stories, individual ritual, family ritual, cultural ritual, and the great world stories. To begin, tonight's topic is praise and thanksgiving. This is the moment in the year when the sun is withdrawing to its furthest point from us. And as that happens, everything in nature makes a different relationship to the sun, including us. And we have made many senses of meaning out of this moment of harvest, this moment of death, this moment of change in our relationship to the sun. One of the things that happens in nature that's most vivid is that the trees turn colors. And what is that? What is that that's really happening? The sap, the life force of the trees is withdrawing, and the chlorophyll, which covers everything in green, that great color of the life force, doesn't have enough energy to be supported, so it withdraws, and it, which is in relationship to the sun, the chlorophyll is what makes the food for the plant out of its relationship to the sun. The chlorophyll also withdraws, and what's left is this incredible, vivid, beautiful gold and pink and red and orange. And that is actually the true nature of that leaf when it's not covered with the green. So that as death comes, as there is the withdrawal of the great powers in the life force, the true essential nature of the thing, its true color, comes forward. And in that blaze of color, there is a sense of fire and vividness of the inner being. And it gives us that one last bright flash of fire before death, before the withdrawal all the way into the cold of the earth. That's a picture of what's going on at this point in time. So there are many rituals that have to do with the fear that we feel during that moment when death is very close to us. We've got the Day of the Dead, All Souls, first the death celebrations, and we also have along with that the harvest and the harvest celebrations. I mean, here is death, who is called the reaper. He is the great harvester. So the food that we're going to take into ourselves where something has died and then it is giving its life force to us, all of these pictures of thanksgiving for the harvest, of thankfulness, of the withdrawal of life and the giving of life, all that sense of cycle is in this picture in the autumn time. One of the main things that we're trying to do with Mythic Imagination Institute is help us to see things in their fullness. Myth and metaphor help us rise up and involve more meaning than simply the literal meaning. There is this beautiful literal meaning of what happens when the chlorophyll withdraws from the leaf. That is also a way to look at many other aspects of our life. So let's look a little bit at what happens next. When the food is harvested, we may eat the fruit, but what happens in nature is that fruit is meant as the food for the seed which is about to descend under the cold earth. The thing about a seed is that it is full of fire. And what I mean by that is it contains both the essential life force of the plant that's going to grow, and it also contains the oil. That's where oil always is stored in a plant. It's inside the seed. So the picture that we've got is of this cold earth, and underneath it, these little bits of fire, this fire seed that's under the ground. And when its like calls to it, that's when the fire of the sun becomes stronger again, it calls to the fire under the ground, and that is going to be the rising and the resurrection of that plant, of that life force. All of it is in relationship to the sun. And those metaphors are something that our rituals and stories always work with, is the idea of the seed growing, the blossoming of the flower, the ripening of the fruit, the essence of the seed going under the earth and then growing again. That's the cycle, and it's a spiritual cycle inside of us as well as a physical cycle in the earth. That cycle, when you see things like the beautiful, vivid colors of the leaves, when you see the blooming of the flower, when you eat the harvest that allows your own life to go forward, its praise is often ripped from your throat. You look into those leaves, that gold in the sun, and that sense of gratitude and thanksgiving wells up in the heart as something truly natural. There's also, when you sit down at the table, and the kind of murmuring happiness of praise and thanksgiving. So let's talk a little bit about this moment of the year and Thanksgiving and harvest. I think Andrew's got some thoughts.
As Honora so beautifully pointed out, life itself is a cycle of thanksgivings, of the birth, of the creation, of the blossoming, of the change away from that. In every stage, there's a place for us to give thanks. Thanksgiving is not a one-time-a-year event for us. No matter how much we think that that's the only time we give thanks and the rest of our lives are bitter and toil and horror, in fact, we give thanks on a constant basis. One of Joseph Campbell's most famous additions to the study of myth is his analysis of the hero's journey. And he speaks of the hero's journey, which goes through so many different stages. But in every stage, there's a place to give thanks. Whether it's the point at which you leave home, whether it's this voluntary journey away, or you've been torn away from the comforts you had, there's a point at which you give thanks for actually being on the journey. And the stage where you meet your mentors, those things, or that person who teaches you, you give thanks for that opportunity. And of course, at the very end of the journey, the point at which you return to society with whatever bounty you have for those you left behind, that itself is a whole process of thanks, where not only is society giving thanks for what you brought back, but you're giving thanks for your return and for the ability to give back to society. And as Campbell notes, we're all on this hero's journey. It's not just something for Ulysses. It's not just something for King Arthur. It's a process we can all undertake. And every stage along the way, we get to give thanks, not just at the point where nature is blooming and showing its thanks in such an obvious chorus and such a beautiful chorus of color and fire, but at every point and in every quiet way. And it's wonderful that we have a chance to recognize this with a day set aside for the beauty of thanks and for the chance to join with other people and recognize those things for which we are thankful and to get to be involved in the activity of giving thanks, and just the very process of giving thanks can fulfill so many of us in so many different ways. I believe the anthropologist Brad Shore has spoken very memorably on the natural, cultural, and familial ritual that we call Thanksgiving.
It's what anthropologists would call a rite of reaggregation. That's the fancy term. It's a ritual where a group that has been dispersed gets to come back together and reassert its power, the power of the – and in this case, this is the ritual in which people come to eat together for the family meal that we're missing so much. And if Americans complain about not eating together in everyday life and that this is something that people talk about a lot, generally American families, as they develop and grow, disperse. And the kids disperse, cousins live in a different town, people break, and families may break up in all different kinds of ways, and they become increasingly diffused and dispersed. And that it's because of that, it's extremely important that periodically, on a regular basis, the family comes together to be a family again. And so this is a rite of reaggregation, maybe the most important American ritual of reaggregation.
I suppose there are many rituals within the ritual.
Yes. Rituals are always kind of modular units that have rituals within rituals, like a Chinese box. And that's why rituals can get very, very complex. Let's take the Thanksgiving dinner. There's a lot of variation in Thanksgiving dinners. So what I would do as an anthropologist is, and I actually asked a class of mine to describe two things. I said, describe your typical Thanksgiving dinner and all the foods that you have, and then tell me your ethnic background. And what came out was very interesting. There's a national component to the meal, which symbolizes our unity as Americans, and that's, of course, generally the turkey. Sort of core foods that everybody was able to identify. We have cranberry sauce, and we have some kind of sweet potatoes or something, and we have turkey. But then you begin to find out that people would also mark their ethnic or regional distinctiveness by another component of the meal. So people would say, well, we have turkey and my grandmother's brisket. Or we have turkey and we always have lasagna. And so what was going on there was the meal was marking a national component, but also symbolizing what we share as a smaller community. Then I discovered that there was another component to the Thanksgiving dinner, and that was something which was Aunt Millie's famous recipe for sweet potatoes, or my grandmother's famous Jell-O mold. It was always something that wasn't fancy. It was kind of home cooking, but it was always identified as attached to a particular person. And those dishes that were unique defined not the nation, not the ethnicity, but the individual family as a unique unit. Every level of our identity is played out through just one meal, the Thanksgiving meal.
So help me better understand myth within the context of Thanksgiving, and all these things that most of us think of as just the ordinary storytelling that happens on these holidays. What would you underscore as, well, that's all part of your family mythology?
Right. Well, mythology is a very big and complicated subject. And like rituals, when we talk about myths, that usually seems to be a bit of a high-blown word for the kinds of things that we're talking about. We like to associate the word myths with what I would call the capital M myths, the big ones. So especially if I use the word mythology, immediately Bullfinch's mythology comes to mind, or the Greek legends, or King Arthur's and his court, or Celtic myths. First of all, these seem to be kind of big formalized stories, and secondly, they tend to be viewed as exotic, either coming from out there in the past or out there in some other culture. And from that point of view, we don't usually think about mythology as something that we do in our family. But if we step back from it, as an anthropologist would, and ask the question, well, what does the word myth really mean? We realize that we're doing myth-making all the time, that myth-making is such an important part of our lives that it's a pity, in a way, to limit the notion of myth to those other myths, the big ones.
Tell me more. Give me
what
more.
What makes a story a myth is very puzzling. If something is just taken as factual, a factual account of something, we tend not to think of it as a myth. But if something is a lie, I mean, absolute bald lie, we don't call it a myth either. The only things that we call myths are stories that are truths that are in fictional form. That is, they are things which have a peculiar mix, a paradoxical mix of fact and fiction. I call myths something like human truths clothed in local fictions. The dinner table in general and the big dinner table at Thanksgiving is very often the place where family stories are told. Now, these stories are myths in the sense that we all know that as we tell these family, little family stories, we embroider them. We know that because different people end up with different versions of the same story. Whenever I get together with families and they start telling these family stories, they all start arguing with each other over the details because clearly something has been added to it over time. I found in the South something very interesting that when I've talked with families, they love recounting stories about eccentric relatives. But what's interesting is that eccentric relatives can never be father or mother. They have to be uncle or aunt. Nobody ever has an eccentric parent. They always have an eccentric uncle or aunt. It has to be skewed one dimension out. It's like that these eccentric people give the family a sense of its eccentric distinctness. They're not big myths. They're what we would call little myths, the small tradition of myth-making with little m. But they turn out to be, in some ways, more important than the big ones. The trick is that the ones that we don't notice that go below consciousness, the myths and the rituals, turn out often to be the shapers of our sense of who we are and where we come from, even more than the ones that we're aware of, the big ones. What Thanksgiving is not a forum for the retelling of the same story. It's a forum to eat together so that we can start talking. It's the engine which makes myths happen on an ongoing basis so that when we talk together and eat together, we begin to share stories.
This is the world's best lasagna. No, really, I mean it. This recipe takes a lot of work, but the results are stupendous every time. My mother, Beverly Erbacher, discovered the recipe when she visited northern Italy as a travel agent. She had to substitute Monterey Jack for one of the cheeses that you just can't get in the U.S., but she made as close a match as possible. You're going to need a really, really large lasagna pan to hold this recipe. Mine is 13 by 18 by 4 inches, and it takes some hefty muscles to lift it when it's loaded with the lasagna. You can cut the recipe in half to use a normal-sized baking pan, but why? So here are your ingredients. 2 pounds of bulk ground sausage, 2 pounds of ground beef, 3 eggs, 3 pieces of stale bread. Now the stale is important. If you try and use fresh, it just won't work right. 3 cups of Parmesan cheese, olive oil, 1 large onion chopped small, but not too small, 1 cup of red wine, 1 large bundle of fresh parsley. Don't use that dried stuff. It just won't taste right. You're going to want about 2 cups of chopped parsley in all, 3 large cans of chopped tomatoes, 2 pounds of mozzarella cheese, 2 pounds of Monterey Jack cheese, 3 large boxes of lasagna noodles. Now, put a huge pot of water on to boil. When it comes to a boil, add a teaspoon of salt and the lasagna noodles. But in the meantime, in a large skillet, cook the sausage and ground beef together and drain the oil. Run the stale bread quickly under water and then squeeze the water out, leaving you with a ball of bread dough. Crumble the bread dough in thumbnail-sized pieces into the meat mixture. Add 1 cup of the chopped parsley, 2 cups of Parmesan cheese, and the 3 beaten eggs to the meat mixture and set it aside. Now open up your windows, turn on your stove air vents, and pray you don't set off your smoke alarm for this next part. It's my family's favorite stage of the recipe, because it makes the whole house smell so good. In a large Dutch oven-sized pot, add enough olive oil to cover the bottom of the pan, then turn the heat way up. Add the chopped onions to the hot oil and burn them. I mean, burn them black. Smoke roiling out of the pan. When they are completely black, pour on a cup of red wine. I put on one of those spatter screens over the pot and pour through it, but watch out for the resulting steam. To the wine and the blackened onions, add the chopped tomatoes and their juices, another cup of chopped parsley, and the meat mixture. In a large bowl, shred the mozzarella and the Monterey Jack cheeses together. Now, when your noodles are done cooking, about 10 minutes, drain them and rinse them in cold water until they're cool enough to handle. Then you take out your monster lasagna pan and start with a layer of sauce, then add noodles, cheese, sauce, until you run out of noodles or sauce. Be sure you end with a layer of noodles. Top the whole thing with a goodly layer of Parmesan cheese, cover the pan with aluminum foil, and bake in a 350-degree oven for 35 minutes, removing the foil for the last 15 minutes. Cool the lasagna for 15 minutes or so before you cut into it. Serve with salad, garlic bread, and a nice Chianti. It's even more wonderful the next day and the next. I usually freeze half the recipe and keep it tucked away for surprise hungry guests. Happy Thanksgiving.
All right. We've got the burning of the olive oil and onions setting off the smoke detector in Brenda's house. This is their Thanksgiving ritual. What kind of Thanksgiving rituals have you got in the Greenberg household?
Well, in our household, we do generally follow a very traditional format where we have the family gathers from around the country, sometimes around the world. We bring in friends, where there's the turkey, where there's a great deal of camaraderie among the family, reconnecting after a long time apart. We're hundreds of miles away from each other. So it's that time to reconnect and give thanks for the ability to have these connections.
I find
it fascinating that so many people do not or cannot follow that sort of tradition. I have seen an amazing growth in a new tradition, which is often called the Orphans Thanksgiving, where people who, for whatever reason, cannot or will not return to their families for Thanksgiving, instead gather with their friends and form their new family and give thanks for that new family around them. And you see this in many different cultures. I was first introduced to it in college with people who just couldn't go home. And slowly I saw it with groups who were not welcome to return to their homes, be they people who were ill or gays who were not accepted by their families or people who'd broken with their families for whatever reason. And I find the whole idea of the Orphans Thanksgiving to be one that offers us a chance for all sorts of new traditions and new rituals, be it the ritual of everybody bringing their potluck item and their constant, I will always bring this item of potluck to the Orphans Thanksgiving. And it's just wonderful to see these traditions and new rituals grow. I've always found it rather interesting that many Native Americans like to talk about the myth of Thanksgiving. And they use this often in two ways. In the first place, they're often talking about how what we traditionally think of the first Thanksgiving, the one at Plymouth Colony, where the Native Americans bring their bounty and help save the colony from starvation and disease, that really isn't the first Thanksgiving. Most Native American cultures that I'm familiar with have a tradition of Thanksgiving dating far back, far beyond Plymouth Colony. And the idea of it there being a first Thanksgiving is really an oxymoron, because you can't have first and Thanksgiving. Everything is a process of Thanksgiving. Whether it's the tradition of the corn and the maize, we know mostly from margarine commercials on TV, but we've also seen in the Hopi tribe, speaking of the corn daughter and giving thanks for her return, whether we see it in the Pueblos, whether we see it in the Greeks when they talk about Demeter and the return of her daughter from the underworld and her giving thanks and returning the bounty of Earth after she's surrounded us and frozen us in winter for so long.
You really shouldn't be taking daughters away from their mothers, but or maybe you should. I mean, that's how this circle of the year happens. Otherwise, we'd be frozen in one time.
Hey, it gets us great dinners out of it.
We get good dinners. We get homecoming. We get football.
We get football. We get the great warrior bands clashing on the field for their pigskin and the great tradition of being able to sit down on a couch and ignore the rest of your family while you watch it in action.
Gladiators. Now, football is an extremely ritualistic enactment of what war, among other things. Maybe the football represents the harvest, the harvest nut.
It's
that
the pigskin being carried to tradition, and the two warrior bands will compete.
The two warrior bands fighting over the nuts. Could be an ancient squirrel. A squirrel
ritual.
All
right, let's take this over, if you don't mind.
But the homecoming aspect of it, I was in, not Tokyo, Kyoto, years ago, and they had these huge fires up on the mountain. And I asked what they were, and they were the characters for different clans, for I don't know what they're called, but the different clans in Japan, and that is their Thanksgiving, where they all come home and the trains are crowded just like our planes and trains and everything are just stuffed with people. I think there's a genetic memory of that we're salmon or something, that we just all have to go home at a certain point, that everybody floods home and then everybody floods back to their other life, especially this culture where we're so dispersed if we don't have a way to come home to ritually, what does that mean? To ritually come back and reconnect to the family story. One of the things I think we're trying to talk about a lot of times is the relationship of the story to the ritual, the story to the ritual. We've got our family story. Our family story may involve lasagna and burning onions. But there's another story that's evolving out of the orphans' Thanksgiving. There's a story that they're telling themselves in relationship to that.
That's very true. And it's interesting that in our culture we think of returning as the way to reconnect the family. Mm. And I often think of the European Thanksgiving as actually being when they get the chance to leave home, the great extended European vacation where France will shut down for several weeks while everybody goes on vacation, which is really for many Europeans the chance to reconnect with their family, no longer surrounded by the burdens of work. And the families will go together to the seashore, to the mountains, to wherever. And it's that process of leaving home and going to a new place that gives them a chance to learn about their family. They're so used to the family being in their traditional roles, taking the same activities over and over again. Whereas once they're gone and in a more serene setting, a less burdened setting, they have the chance to see each other in a new light and to really reconnect. And it's that process of leaving the home for which not only give thanks for a chance to go swim at the seashore, but a chance to be with their family in a whole new way and in a whole new light.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, in the relationship to nature, the sap is withdrawing into the roots, and there's, I think, an element of homecoming that has to do with withdrawing into the roots, and there's an element, as you say, of seeing people in a whole new light, of circling that in another way that brings you to another way to perceive the people in your life. It's a different way, and the burdens are different. I'm thinking about some of the rituals in my family. One thing that seemed to be a ritual, this was actually not meant to be a ritual, but was spilling some major food element on the floor as we were trying to get it to the table. That seemed to be
the accidental tradition
of turkey tetrazzini all over the floor. But one thing that really is a ritual for my family is music.
Mine as well.
Everybody in my family does some kind of musical offering after dinner. So we actually do not do football as much as we do music. I've got two brothers. One of my brothers is a guitarist and writes his own music and his own songs, and he'll often sing those. And my other brother is Daniel Sheen, is a concert pianist. And I think we've got a lovely recording of some of the type of music that Daniel does. He's a classical pianist, so I think we'll hear a bit of that.
We return thanks to our mother, the earth, which sustains us. We return thanks to the rivers and streams which supply us with water. We return thanks to all herbs which furnish medicines for the cure of our diseases. We return thanks to the corn and to her sisters, the bean and the squashes, which give us life. We return thanks to the wind, which moving the air has banished diseases. We return thanks to the moon and stars, which have given to us their light when the sun was gone. We return thanks to the sun, that he has looked upon the earth with a beneficent eye. Lastly, we return thanks to the Great Spirit, in whom is embodied all goodness, and who directs all things for the good of his children. An Iroquois Prayer.
The purpose of Mythic Imagination Institute is that we create experiences of the mystery and the metaphor in myth and story through art and hands-on activity and cross-disciplinary conversation. And it's such an interesting thing to do, it's such a powerful thing to do, that what it's done is bring together many, many volunteers who give thousands of hours at this point to put together our conferences and other events and experiences that we do. I especially want to now, in the spirit of Thanksgiving, give thanks to a few people. One, of course, is my co-president and partner in crime, Michael Carlin, who was one of the founders of this whole process and a very remarkable and wonderful man. I want to give thanks to all the volunteers who work with us. And over the series of these podcasts, you'll hear from many of them. One of the people that you heard from today with the lasagna recipe is our office goddess who runs the whole show, is the center, and that was Brenda Sutton. I want to thank especially Brad Barnett and Creative Digital Group for letting us use the studio and putting this work together for us. You can find Creative Digital Group on the web at exactly that, creativedigitalgroup.com. And you can find us, Mythic Imagination, mythicimagination.org. Mythic Imagination's musical introduction was by Jeffrey Armus. He can be found on the web at jeffreyarmus.com. That's A-R-M-E-S. Brad Shore, who did that wonderful explanation, is an anthropologist and the director of the Mariel Center at Emory University. Mariel is the Center for Myth and Ritual in American Life. They do fascinating work over there. The interviewer was Mary Beth Kirshner. She's an independent radio producer who produced a two-hour special on the Mythic Journeys conference that was done in 2004. Brad Barnett read the Iroquois Prayer. I'd also like to thank Donna Barnett, who with great creativity and intelligence has put all of this together with great love and enthusiasm and kindness.
We give thanks in many different ways, but perhaps one of the most common ones is prayer. It doesn't matter to whom you direct these prayers or even if you direct them to anyone. In many different ways, in many different forms, when we pray, we give thanks for the bounty of our life, for the very gift of life, and for the very journey that life takes us along. As we prepare to journey to join our families, our communities, and our world in singing songs of praise and thanksgiving, let's end this time we've spent together with another special prayer from Chief Jake Swamp, a spiritual leader of the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation and the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy.
This morning we are thankful that we have been brought together to be with one another. We should bring our minds together as if we became one person, as we remind each other of our responsibility to our home, the earth. We give thanks to the Mother Earth who provides for everything that we need to nourish us each and every day. We give thanks to all the bodies of water, the water that is responsible in taking away our thirst. We give thanks to all the medicinal herbs that have been planted that take away diseases and sicknesses. We give thanks to all the foods that come from the ground. We give thanks to all the fish that live in the waters, all the insects. We give thanks to all the animals who are roaming about in the forests, performing their duty. We give thanks to the trees around the world for each and every day we use their energy. We pay attention to the birds who sing their beautiful songs each time when we are taken into loneliness. We only need to listen to the birds sing their beautiful songs, and that will comfort our minds and be well again. We take our minds to the four directions where the four winds come from. And we give thanks to the air that we breathe. We give thanks to our oldest grandfathers, the thunder beings, for bringing the waters to bring refreshment to all the bodies of the waters of the world. We give thanks to our oldest brother, the sun, for he is the one that shines his light so that we may see creation clearly, giving his warmth so everything can grow. We give thanks to our oldest grandmother, the moon, for she is the one that leads all the female cycles of the world. We give thanks to all the stars, her helpers, for the stars are the ones that bring the dew to the plant life when we have dry seasons. We give thanks to the four sacred beings that were assigned to watch over the human family so that they would not self-destruct. And now we have reached that part of our world where the Great Spirit lives beyond the heavens somewhere, although we do not know the face of the Creator. We can feel its presence within every living thing, including within us. And so we give thanks to this great mystery, the Creator of all things that we enjoy every day. So this morning, we have opened our gathering with thankfulness for being brought together this morning. And we give special thanks and greeting to our great Creator, the Great Spirit. Yama, go well. Thank you.
Our next series of podcasts will explore the traditions of light in the seasons of darkness.